We get underway by welcoming into the program writer Colin Fleming. Good day, Mr. Fleming.
You hear me? If while you're saying all of that, I'm chanting like a madman, does that come through, or does it just come in like 5 seconds ago when you press the button?
Not until the moment I pause and Carrie slides up your pot.
Okay. All right, good. So I can do the chanting.
Right. Oh, yes. But I mean, if you want, we can start it again, and you can chant away.
It's all right. I've worked it out of my system.
All right. Good. I want you to do what you need to do and get that. If you need to purge here with us, feel free.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
That's why we're here.
Be tending to my relief.
As always, many topics to cover this afternoon. And, we want to start with the idea of martyrdom. That word gets tossed about a lot, and I'm not sure everybody has the proper understanding of what it means.
No, I don't think they do. It's troubling because when we don't know what basic words mean, and you use a basic word correctly, you can get in a lot of trouble. And it's just because you actually know the English language. And then we have this free-for-all. When no one knows what the word means, we can imbue a word with any meaning we wish it to have. And then it's a way to weaponize language via this chaos of stripping language of any... To say something very basic, factual, and true, especially true, you could say that George Floyd is not a martyr. Now, saying that today is like such a revolutionary remark. It's like a call to arms, right? It's like, oh, let's go get this guy. He's done it. Let's cancel this person. But the word martyr means that you are fully aware of what your cause, what you are attempting to bring about, what you're attempting to change, can result in you being harmed of a bodily nature. It's a decision, by definition, to carry on with that knowledge, usually after you've been at your cause for an extended period of time. It's different than being the tragic victim of a murder. They're completely different things, because there's no decision involved. If I go out on the street today and leave this death trap for the first time in 2 days, and some drunk driver runs me down, I'm not a martyr against drunk drivers. I'm the victim of a tragic accident by someone who was inebriated, reckless, manslaughter, that kind of thing.
Absolutely, because there has to be that intention. It does not take away from the tragic nature of what happened, but it's important. And like so much else, I think of the word hero is often misused. And to do that is to demean from those people who are actual heroes.
Hero is a word that's now a preface to a photo op and to clicks and to various forms of virtue signaling. It's something that's used as a PR ready-made. Like Joan of Arc was a martyr. And again, that is taking something away from martyrs who are often heroes. They're not necessarily, because sometimes they could have been up to no good, and there were people behind them, and you didn't figure out, like, there were French Revolution, there were martyrs, and you can argue about the emotional and the ethical value of something like the French Revolution. Was it something that had to happen, or could change have come about a different way? But you're committed to something very hard when you are a martyr, and you're usually committed alone, on your own. You might have some people who get into your cause, who follow you, that kind of thing. And it doesn't mean that you are committing to something that you know is going to end in your death or bodily harm, but you know it's a possibility, and you hope that it doesn't come to that and that you prevail. That's the same thing with hero. Everybody's a hero now and again. Everybody's a hero for something that we might see them do, but sometimes that's just a case of doing the right thing. Like I think about, Brock Turner, the Stanford racist swimmer guy or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two guys going by, right, on their bikes, and they see him doing what he's doing with a person motionless behind a dumpster or whatever it might have been. And everyone said that those two people were heroes. And I thought, they're people who did the right thing in that situation. And if one of them might have been behind that dumpster and Brock Turner was with his buddy, then he also could have interceded too. That doesn't make you a hero. It doesn't make you a good person, because we don't know what's going on in the rest of that individual's life. We just know that in the moment they did the right thing, which counts for a lot, but it's also not this huge overarching definition of who an individual is.
So does the term hero have to refer to a larger body of work?
I think we can have heroic moments where people who ordinarily would not be inclined to do very great things or have the emotional wherewithal or the courage to do great things find a way to do something that is truly heroic. I like to believe that that's a possibility of the human condition. You might not be George Washington 365 days a year, but when the bombs go off on Boylston Street, you run back into the fray and you pull out who you can pull out. I think that's a heroic moment where we are able to sometimes transcend what would otherwise be our limitations.
When you think of the word martyr, who's perhaps the first person who comes to mind for you?
I feel like I'm pretty deep in the process of it right now, but I hope it doesn't come to that, to be honest with you, as anyone who reads the blog would know. I think there are all kinds of different degrees of martyr. I think sometimes you can be a martyr. Joan of Arc is probably the one that comes to mind to me, because you're essentially picking death by pogrom, and you're not relinquishing your beliefs. And we've talked about Christ as a person, not the super-duper magic guy in the sky, and decisions that he made knowing what was probably going to happen to him at some point. And it wasn't like some far-fetched theory for him in his case, because that was the kind of thing that happened at the time.
Right.
It wasn't like so unusual to have someone nailed to a cross. It's not like people sat around and thought, you know what, would just be like this wicked singular punishment for this guy. That was kind of like getting arrested back in the day, a long time ago, 2,000 years ago back in the day. But that was just something that could befall you. And he was rolling that kind of dice, and his number came up. But he knew. And you would have had to have been an idiot not to have known, because your predecessors, people who hadn't gone as far as you had gone or he was going, would have had that outcome in store for them. So I think those two are ones that come to mind. And then you have other kinds where maybe it wasn't bodily, but I think someone like Orson Welles was a martyr for his art. People loathed him, and he kept doing it, and he believed in it. And that was a different kind of death, I would say, a death of having no support and people really not pulling for you and no one in your camp. And that can be a kind of fate worse than death sometimes.
We're talking with Colin Fleming on Downtown. Let's move to another topic, but one that certainly resonates in the times we're in, a story that has entered the public domain, first published back in 1924, The Most Dangerous Game.
Yes, and this is a story that you probably read it in school, right?
Like, yeah.
I don't know. I would think a lot of people read it in school. It's one of the most read short stories in America. And there's all kinds of different variations on this story, too. You see it in, shows, movies, other stories, old radio programs. There's been so many adaptations of this story. And what it is that there's this remote island, and this guy is on it. There's actually an Orson Welles version, a radio version, where he plays this kind of madman on this island. And the island is conveniently situated near a reef. Ships wreck. Few people make it from the reef to the island, and you're in this guy's mansion. He has like a manservant, all that stuff that you'd expect. And then he's like, oh, I have this thing that I'm into. And they're like, oh, cool, what's that? He's like, I like to hunt people. People are like, ha, 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 ha. It's so funny. He's like, no, I give you a head start, and then they come for you. that's what happens. And it's a hunt. It's like a great idea. And this guy, the guy who wrote it, like he wrote like comedies, wrote like a Harold Lloyd film, which is like pretty funny. And so it's hunting humans. And I realize now, because you've seen this ramp up during quarantining, and I think that's because people can't be alone with their own thoughts and their anger needs a new place to go, or a place to go more vociferously. We hunt people. Like you go away from Twitter for like 3 hours, right? And you log back on, and somebody has been hunted and caught, and they're hanging like catch a tiger, hang it by a tree type of deal. And it's like, okay, they're done. We hunt people digitally now. We go in, we don't just like try to embarrass them. We try to end them. We try to end their ability to live a life, to provide food for their family. We seek to have them cease to be.
That's an interesting perspective, and I'm not sure you're wrong on that. Let's talk about a very interesting piece you wrote. I think it was published last week in Jazz Times about the death of George Floyd and John Coltrane and some interesting parallels there.
I was interested in what the artist has as a reaction for things that happen in our society and what artists normally do now. And what almost everyone in publishing does is they take to Facebook and they fill up Facebook with 60 posts a day and they change their filters. And I just thought, you know what? This is not what a real artist, it's not what the response of a real artist would be. And John Coltrane had this song called Alabama. And it was recorded in 1963 and it came out early in 64. And it was about these. It was an instrumental song. It wasn't, there were no lyrics or anything, but it stemmed from the bombing of this church in Montgomery, Alabama, and four young African-American females were killed.
Right.
I just thought, like, that was what he chose to do. He chose to create something that would channel and funnel emotion in a way that would cause people experiencing something from afar to have an experience with it in a new way, and along with that would come a different perspective. Because when you have different feelings, you have a different emotional vantage point to something, it creates different thoughts, it leads to conclusions that might be more fruitful. And so I wrote about that in lieu of George Floyd, because nobody does that anymore. Nobody writes about something, creates something right away, in the moment, shortly thereafter, that's going to tap into that kind of raw zeitgeist. And I think that's really what the artist is there for in many ways, or ought to be, and something that we've gotten away from with a kind of tragic implication that it's furthered our devolution as a culture.
And I think of a couple other examples of that in pop culture and pop music. The Beach Boys in 1963, Brian Wilson sat down and wrote The Warmth of the Sun, I believe, the night that JFK was assassinated. And that was his way of expressing it through his art. And then, of course, Crosby, Stills, and Nash coming out with, I believe it was Neil Young's song, Ohio, literally within weeks of the killings at Kent State in 1970.
The timing component's a big part of it. It really is. And I've noticed that not only do people lack the creative fecundity to create something that powerful, they end up now taking forever to do anything they do. So there really is such a void for somebody. I remember, so I mentioned the bombs going off on Boylston Street earlier. I wrote a story 2 days after that, and it was an editor at Harper's wanted to publish it, but his boss said no, and I'd offered it to the New Yorker, and it could have ran the next week. It ended up being published by a place called the Virginia Quarterly Review. But this was before that. It was even announced that Brothers had anything to do with this. Like, we would have been investigated by the FBI. That's how fast it was. And in a weekly like the New Yorker, you could have had it out the next week. And that would have blown people's minds and also served as a bomb. And that timing component is key. Someone like Dylan can watch something happen in the news, or he certainly could in the year you mentioned, 1963. Boom, he's coming out with Blowing in the Wind. But now it's like, oh, I took like 14 years to birth this, and I went through these drafts, and I workshopped it. Yeah, that was like, shut up, you have no talent. Do something else with your life, because you're not helping anyone. You're here for the assuagement of your little ego.
All right, finally, we want to talk about the 50th anniversary of Gimme Shelter, the documentary on the Stones' U.S. tour from 69, and of course, the events that culminated with the deaths at Altamont.
Yes, in that film, you see like this blurry murder, right? It's almost like the Antonioni film Blow Up, except here it's blown up in cinematic form. And I remember, film came out before I was alive, but like I discovered this film pretty early on as a music fan, being so into the Rolling Stones. It was like considered so shocking what you saw happen that they managed to catch in this film. And they had to like freeze the frame, right, and put that little lightning bubble over it. It was like, here is like a knife going into this guy. And even then, you were kind of like, well, okay, if you say so, obviously he's not alive anymore. And it just, it made me think about how inured we're becoming to violence right now in terms of this cinematic amateur auteur violence where we're all out. We're all auteurs right now with our cameras, our phones. We just whip them out. And you choose the perspective when you start filming, when you stop filming, right? You make the narrative, which is a highly agenda-driven narrative. And then you just get this violence that's tossed up there on social media. And there are things that are so much worse than what you see in Gimme Shelter. Just, I was looking at, I don't play them, right? It's just not something that I want to bring into my life. I understand what the words mean when I see a caption underneath a still person unconscious on the street. And I read the story that a 15-year-old who is like freeze-framed in mid-kick for the JPEG kicked this insensate person who was already like just out of it in the head in like until like their head practically exploded. And people are just commenting like, yeah, that's a pretty gnarly video. Well, it's like, what the hell, man? Like, I don't understand how we're just that deadened to that kind of violence. Because when we're deadened to that kind of violence, we're deadened to linguistic violence and emotional violence and the hunt of the mob, most dangerous game violence. And it's all interrelated. And it's like we're so focused on the sensational aspect that we're not putting the entire puzzle piece together.
And is part of that because it's everywhere in our culture, that it's in film, it's in television shows, it's in video games. And I'm not one to say, oh gosh, the reason we have so much violence is because kids see it in all these video games. I don't believe that for a moment, but I do think there's the possibility that people get desensitized to the violence by seeing it everywhere.
What was the Looney Tunes? So Elmer Fudd, right?
Yes.
And he can't have, so like what's he walk around with now? Like a slingshot? Like it's, but you have so much of everything else out there, like Netflix, that's so gun dependent. And what I mean by that, it's not like I'm saying, oh, you can't have this gun in this film noir, whatever it is, but it's become a crutch because there's a hole in narrative making ability. And when there's a hole in your ability to flesh out narrative, think of something, a film we both like, Out of the Past. Now, in Out of the Past, people are shot with guns. Do you even remember when I say that to you right now? Like, you don't, right?
That's not
what you think of when you think of that film. Surely, at some point, the guy who betrays the Mitchum character, Jane Greer shoots him. Cold blood. Okay. But, like, you don't, when you think of her character, you think of the human components of that character, including the human evil component. You don't think of bang, bang, pretty, pretty type of stuff. You go to the more overlapping, empathetical qualities. But now it's just like, okay, well, you know, we don't know what to do with this plot. Don't know how to resolve this. Set him on fire, have a dragon do this, lop off his head for the king. And it's just a quick fix.
And that's why I've never understood like the Saw franchise, porn, any of that. I never quite grasped the attraction to that.
I think that stems from neither have I. And I knew this person once. And that was what, this was so odd to me. They thought of it as like a Halloween film, like Hostel. Like that's not, slasher films, even like, I guess Friday the 13th, because they're around a campfire at some point with like some marshmallows, but like to me, like a Halloween film is Frankenstein or Dracula or whatever. But like Hostel, I don't know why. If I think that there's something not going as it ought to be going in your internal life, if you are satiated by that, and that is what you sit down to spend your time with. I like lots of really bad things. I'll watch like Last Man Standing because I have no life and people seem to like each other and it's a way I relax at night in the background. But like if you're just firing up the Hostel, I don't know, man. I think you've made a wrong turn or two internally somewhere along the road.
I could not agree more, as is often the case when Colin joins us. Colin Fleming, check out his work, of course, at colinflemminglit.com. Thank you, my friend. We'll do it again next week.
Okay, sounds good, buddy.